Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Hussein Ibish of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, who discusses the relationship between a U.S. plan for war with Iraq and escalating violence in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Stephen Hill, with the Center for Voting and Democracy, who looks beyond the recent victory for campaign finance reform legislation in Congress to grassroots efforts to strengthen democracy. And Randy Zimmerman, headlines editor with Free Speech Radio News, who talks about the end of the 26-month-old strike by Pacifica reporters against censorship that rocked Pacifica Network News, the nation's oldest progressive news service. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The New Internationalist magazine reports that global warming has found its first victim. The Pacific island state of Tuvalu, home to 11,000 people, has given up the fight against rising seas and started talks with New Zealand permitting an orderly migration of island residents. Tuvalu, a collection of 9 islands, has no mobile phones, 1 radio station, and no standing army, but soon will be swamped out by rising seas, largely caused by the industrialized world's addiction to fossil fuels and the production of greenhouse gases. More groups of eco-refugees from rising global temperature could emerge in the near future. They could include 7 million people on Pacific Islands, or 20 million people in Bangladesh, who might be forced to move because of massive flooding. Scientists are also alarmed about the ice shelf the size of Rhode Island that recently split off from Antarctica and its effect on coastal flooding. The United Nations estimates that the cost from natural disasters attributed to climate change now totals $300 billion a year. But environmental activists wonder how poor nations will make a claim on this ecological debt. The London-based Global Commons Institute is working on a formula with Western governments, financial institutions, and developing nations. The aim is to get rich nations to pay for using more than their share of natural resources, with the proceeds going to help the developing world. Last fall, Pakistani Mohammed Butt died in the custody of the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service while he was held at the Hudson County Detention Center in northern New Jersey. He died of a heart attack, which the New Jersey medical examiner said was due to natural causes. According to the Progressive magazine, Butt's roommate told a Human Rights Watch official in January that the detainee had requested medical assistance 5 or 6 times in the day prior to his heart attack. And, on last October the 24th, Butt woke up with a severe pain and pounded on the prison door for 5 minutes seeking assistance. He was ignored. Soon afterwards, he fell asleep and died. In recent months, human rights workers are reporting a growing number of cases of mistreated detained immigrants in the wake of the September 11th terrorist attacks. There are allegations of detainees being beaten, locked into solitary confinement, injected with substances without their permission, and the denial of blankets, food, and toilet paper. Former federal prosecutor Michael Wilds, now a defense attorney, represents 5 Israeli nationals who were stopped near the George Washington Bridge in New York after the terrorist attacks. He charges that 4 of the detainees were beaten by INS guards. The defense lawyer insists, "The government is punishing innocent people. We must temper our response with justice, or put in jeopardy that we're trying to protect." The news magazine In These Times reports that the Bush administration has moved to the hard right in naming members to the President's Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS. The administration has tapped former Oklahoma Congressman Tom Coburn as co-chairman of the AIDS Council. As a leading spokesman for the House GOP majority on health care, Coburn called for the firing of the head of the Centers for Disease Control for his promoting condoms as a means to prevent the spread of AIDS. Coburn is also considered by gay activists as having one of the most homophobic voting records in Congress. The other co-chairman on AIDS policy is former Health and Human Services Secretary Louis Sullivan, who, in the first Bush administration, worked to ban the entry into the U.S. of people with HIV and AIDS. The ban led to an international boycott of the 1990 International AIDS Conference held in San Francisco. Further, the AIDS Council's new director is Patricia Funderburk Ware, a conservative activist who ran the group Americans for a Sound AIDS Policy, whose main objective was to push for abstinence-only sex education as the only federally funded school program on human sexuality. In contrast, only 3 members of the 35-member council are HIV positive, and there is no one from the medical research community. As Asia Russell of ACT UP Philadelphia remarked, "It appears as if Bush has declared people with AIDS as public enemy number one." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Rees.
For several months now, the Bush administration has threatened to launch a new war against Iraq. Washington's justification for an attack on Baghdad is based on the unproven allegation that Saddam Hussein possesses weapons of mass destruction and may be developing nuclear capability. Vice President Dick Cheney's recent visit to the Middle East, designed to gain regional support for future U.S. military action against Iraq, fell short when some Arab heads of state publicly announced their opposition to the war plan. Leaders of the 12 nations Cheney visited were more focused on the escalating violence between Israelis and Palestinians, expressing hope that progress for peace can be made at the Arab League summit meeting in Beirut, where Saudi Arabia unveiled their peace initiative. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Hussein Ibish, communications director with the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, who discusses the relationship between a possible future U.S. attack on Iraq and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
The notion of attacking Iraq, I think, is incredibly tempting to this administration for multiple reasons. I mean, first of all, these are, after all, the refugees of the first Bush administration. I mean, not just, you know, Bush son of Bush, but also General Powell, Mr. Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, and a whole crew of others who were there for Gulf War No. 1 and who have sort of lived with the consequences, the supposed failure to get rid of Saddam Hussein, the mistake, et cetera. For someone like General Powell, who's actually not a hawk on this issue, it's probably the only accusation that can be thrown against him that has public resonance as a kind of failure in his career or a blot on his copybook. So there's that. There's also, of course, the strategic imperative the United States has had for over 20 years now, since the fall of the Shah of Iran, of trying to control the Persian Gulf without having a compliant regime in either of the large countries of the region, Iraq or Iran. So there's been a longstanding strategic imperative to try to get a compliant regime in one of those two capitals. And, of course, there is great anger at the 9/11 attacks in a kind of sense that, you know, this sort of authorizes the United States to do whatever it wants in the Middle East and in the Arab world, you know, without compunction. So, you know, even if Iraq has nothing to do with this kind of terrorism, nothing to do with Al-Qaeda, nothing to do with 9/11, all of which I believe are true, you can still sort of peg this to 9/11 because, you know, 9/11 was done by Arabs and the Iraqis are also Arabs, therefore there's a connection, therefore let's go for it, boys. I mean, basically that is the argument, more or less. So, you know, the United States is very keen on that, but I think, as Cheney's trip showed, there's really no enthusiasm in the region for this because, first of all, the regional powers, the regional players like, say, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, et cetera, you know, don't feel in any way that Iraq is a threat to them at the moment. When they did feel Iraq was a threat in 1991, they were quite enthusiastic about joining an American-led anti-Iraqi coalition. But now I think it's generally recognized in the region and elsewhere that Iraq is a country on its knees, that it's surrounded by enemies, and that it's really not in a position to threaten anybody. And if it does have some special weapons, some biological or chemical weapons of some kind, that it's certainly not going to use them unless the Saddam government feels that it's about to be overthrown, which certainly begs the question why you would want to launch an invasion that might provoke that. So, frankly, the regional powers, knowing this and understanding how destabilizing this would be, knowing the United States doesn't have a coherent plan for getting rid of Saddam Hussein, asking who the next government will be and receiving only blank stares in reply, are not enthusiastic. Moreover, I'm sure they've all been pointing out, in fact, it's well known that they've all been pointing out to Vice President Cheney and to others, that the nightmare scenario for them and for the reputation of the United States in the region would be to have the United States attacking Iraq at the same time that the Israelis are continuing to suppress the Palestinians and enforce their occupation with massive violence. So that shows no sign of ending, and in fact, the conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis is only intensifying, and there's no real positive movement towards starting the kind of political process that would actually end the conflict. So I think the Arab states are extremely concerned that the kind of double whammy just can't be dealt with regard to their domestic public opinion, that, you know, it's bad enough to have the Israelis going on a rampage against the Palestinians, or bad enough to have the United States launching an unprovoked attack on Iraq. The combination of the two, I think, is a complete nightmare for the regimes, and actually for anyone who wants to try to tell the Arab public that, you know, what they're witnessing is not part of a clash of civilizations, is not part of a generalized assault by the Western powers against the Arab world or against Islam or what have you. In other words, that scenario would play beautifully into the hands of fanatics like Osama bin Laden, who are trying to tell the Arabs, and so far have not succeeded in convincing them, that that there is a generalized conflict going on here. The United States has been making these rather half-hearted moves to try to create a ceasefire, but, you know, it's totally inadequate, and it's actually, I think, quite pathetic.
Well, do you think continued conflict and violence between Israelis and Palestinians will forestall a Bush plan to attack Iraq?
I don't know. It depends what sort of attack they want to launch. If they want to try bombing and just using some very small amounts of American ground forces and promoting some sort of internal rebellion from, I don't know who, various opposition groups, you know, then I suppose it's possible. But if the United States is contemplating a scenario where tens of thousands of American troops would be used, or hundreds of, maybe even 100 to 200,000, which is what a lot of generals are talking about now, then certainly that would require the cooperation of Saudi Arabia, and certainly Turkey, and possibly others as well. And, you know, for this, you need to get an agreement. And it's possible that if the second scenario is the one that finds favor, that the lack of progress in a ceasefire might impede the United States in this and make them think twice. But I have to tell you, living in Washington and meeting these administration types and you know, socially off the record, et cetera, I have to tell you, it's my view that there is a profound recklessness at work in some elements of the administration. And there are people you do meet who look you straight in the eye and say with absolute, in an absolutely convincing way, that they simply don't care about Arab public opinion. They're fed up with the Arabs. They've had enough. They're going to get rid of Saddam, and they don't care if anybody wants to go along, and they don't care about anybody anyway, and the hell with them. And this is really an attitude that you see quite a bit of in the Bush administration. I think it bespeaks a profound recklessness, and it should be very frightening to people.
Hussein, I wondered if you would comment briefly on the chances for any breakthrough as a result of the Arab League meeting.
Well, I don't think there are any chances for a breakthrough as long as the United States refuses to place any pressure whatsoever on Israel to return to the negotiating table. I mean, that's what you've got. We still seem to think that this is just a nuisance that should go away, and we don't seem to understand what those Palestinians are so worked up about, and we really don't seem to care.
That was Hussein Ibish of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. Contact the committee by calling area code 202-244-2990 or visit their website at www.adc.org. After 7 years of hard-fought legislative battles, members of the U.S. Senate, by a 60-40 vote, followed the House in passing the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform bill. The legislation, sponsored by Senators McCain and Feingold, along with Representatives Shays and Meehan in the House, will ban unregulated soft money contributions made to political parties by corporations, unions, and individuals. The measure will also restrict TV and radio issue advertising referring to specific candidates within 30 days of a primary or 60 days of a general election, and double individual hard money contribution limits from $1,000 to $2,000. Although President Bush has said he will reluctantly sign the bill into law, a coalition of opponents of campaign finance reform vowed to fight the legislation in the courts. Senator Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, along with former Whitewater Independent Counsel Kenneth Starr and attorney Floyd Abrams, declared the bill unconstitutional and believe the Supreme Court will eventually rule in their favor. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Stephen Hill, Western Regional Director of the Center for Voting and Democracy. Hill looks beyond the recent campaign finance reform victory in Congress to a national grassroots movement working to overhaul the U.S. electoral system and strengthen democracy. Their recent successes include public financing of elections in several states and the adoption of instant runoff voting in San Francisco and 49 towns in Vermont.
I view the McCain-Feingold bills as a big triumph, not only for campaign finance reformers, but just for reform in general. I mean, for one thing, it's hard to keep people motivated when they see proposals continually shot down. So I think getting something through, getting a victory is always a good thing. And I think also in McCain-Feingold and going after the soft money problem is going after a real feature of our particular democracy. You know, as some of the research of my center has shown, most elections are not competitive simply because of how the districts are drawn during redistricting, where, you know, a district is made to be so Democratic or so Republican, so lopsided one way or the other. It really isn't any chance for anyone else to win. But what that means is that the handful of races that are competitive, those become the ones that determine the control of the legislature. For instance, the U.S. House. And that's what this soft money really has been about. It's been about the ability of party leaders to collect money from incumbents in basically safe seats, and then they focus it like a lens on these handful of seats that are going to determine so much power and control in the legislature. And so by curtailing that, it's going to break up some of these political machines that have come about as a result of this soft money process and the lack of competition in most races, and so the legislature is being determined by a handful of races. So I view that as a win. Now, there's no question that trying to stop the flow of money in politics is a little bit like trying to stop a river with a net. The money finds a way through, around, and others. So there's no question there's going to be a call now for other additional reforms like public financing of elections, like instant runoff voting, proportional representation, and others. And I think all of these are to the good. We need to start moving forward on these other parts of the reform agenda now.
Stephen Hill, when you look at some of the grassroots campaigns going on around the country on electoral reform, you see people advocating and actually passing in some states public financing of election campaigns. There's also the efforts at the municipal level to put in place proportional representation or instant runoff voting. Tell us briefly some of the important victories and directions of these grassroots campaigns.
Well, there have been some important victories for public financing in the states of Maine and Massachusetts and Arizona. I think they were important because they were the first, so to speak, in terms of statewide. At the city level, there's I think just about a dozen cities around the country that are using public financing of elections. We passed public financing of elections here in San Francisco a couple years ago. I was part of that campaign. And, you know, and also cities of Los Angeles and Long Beach and Oakland have also passed it, in New York City as well, Los Angeles. So, you know, I think that this is the future of what we have to do with our politics. I think the argument for public financing, to my mind, is an infrastructure question. I mean, we wouldn't allow or ask the parties to count their ballots themselves. We have the taxpayers pay for it, and we have a public entity do that. It's just seemed to be the best and fairest way to do it. Similarly, I think we need to look at the financing of how we get information into voters' hands. So like some states and cities already use things like voters' guides. To me, this is just public financing of elections is just an extension of that. We're simply going to make sure there's at least a floor that everyone gets to speak a certain minimum amount, even as some parties that are better financed get to speak a lot more. But we want to make sure that every candidate and party has the ability to get information into the hands of voters so that voters can make informed and responsible decision about important policy questions, and also to help foment some debate and discussion about the issues of our times, which under the current incentives of winner-take-all politics, where you use polling and focus groups and everything else to figure out what the swing voters are, and that's who the two major parties target, it means most voters aren't swing voters, and they're being left on the political sidelines. The issues are not being addressed. So public financing of elections will bring candidates into the fray that can bring ideas into the public discussions that right now are being ignored. We also are seeing attempts at changing things like the voting system itself. And here in San Francisco, we just recently passed instant runoff voting for all our local elections. And again, there the idea behind it is opening up the political system, giving voters more choice, allowing voters to rank their candidates, first choice, second choice, third choice, rather than simply being stuck with picking the lesser of two evils. So, you know, these are very hopeful signs. A lot of them are happening locally and sometimes at the state level, but I think we're going to see a lot of it, more of this happening in the next few years.
That was Stephen Hill with the Center for Voting and Democracy. Contact the center by calling area code 301-270-4616 or visit their website at www.fairvote.org. On January 31, 2000, over 40 freelance reporters launched a strike against Pacifica Network News to protest the network's censorship of coverage of its own internal disputes. The strike marked a turning point in the national battle to save the progressive character of the Pacifica Radio Network, which critics charge was under assault from within by a corporate clique on its national board. Over the last 2 years, the global picket line of freelancers grew to over 150 as progressive reporters around the world refused to work for Pacifica News. The strikers joined together to produce free speech radio news as an alternative to Pacifica's nightly newscast. Last December, an out-of-court settlement ended several lawsuits filed by dissidents at Pacifica and created an interim board representing all factions. At its March meeting, the new Pacifica board unanimously passed a resolution it negotiated with the strikers to end the 26-month-old strike that rocked the nation's oldest progressive news service. Randy Zimmerman is headlines editor for Free Speech Radio News, as well as a programmer at WMNF in Tampa, Florida. She was part of the negotiating team and spoke with your reporter, Denise Manzari, about the settlement and the future of news at Pacifica.
January 31st of 2000 is when the stringers originally went on strike, and it was after quite a series of events that had taken place at Pacifica. I think probably the main event was the removal of Dan Coughlin as national news director, and as well as then a series prior to that of Pacifica stations and the Pacifica Foundation interrupting any programming or out-and-out censoring any programming that talked about the internal conflict at Pacifica.
What is your opinion about PNN did not want internal struggles aired on the station, and if anybody did that in any way, obviously they were fired and banned.
I think it's interesting how it was played out. Let's remember that Pacifica is a listener-sponsored organization, and one of the only places where listeners can hear about Pacifica is on the Pacifica airwaves. That's very different from a lot of other organizations, and I think it's incumbent, especially when a story becomes a national event, as did what Dan Coughlin was trying to report when there was an affiliate boycott of Pacifica programming for one day, where other major news outlets reported on the event, Pacifica could not report on its own event. And I think that's very different from folks who maybe wanted to talk about the conflict on public affairs airwaves or local news airwaves, and then was fired and banned, because what happened throughout the network over that time period is some people were fired and banned when they talked about internal issues and others were not.
Well, as a result, over 100 grassroots radio journalists began producing free speech radio news, and that is registered basically as a nonprofit in California.
That's correct. It's a nonprofit organization, Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. It was initiated by about four originating strikers, and over the course of time, through education of existing Pacifica stringers, said, hey, we want to work for you folks. We want to support your strike. You're supported by a number of other labor unions we support. And over time, that list has grown to probably now 150 reporters around the world in every continent with the exception of Antarctica, because reporters are absolutely thrilled and love reporting about news that concerns them and people at a grassroots level from an organization that's built around workers' rights.
Will all of these reporters become part of the PNN newscast. Again, you're saying financially that doesn't seem feasible. But what do you think in the next year or so? Do you think that may happen?
For 18 months, the Pacifica National cannot, without calling back the original PNN staff, create another national news show. And I think financially, Pacifica has close to or over a $5 million debt. And they're going to want to wait and stabilize that, which most folks are estimating will take at least a year. I don't know if or when that's going to happen.
You were also, along with Ken Patterson and Vanessa Tate, part of the negotiating team regarding the ending of the PNN strike. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and what were the final negotiations that ended the strike, I believe, on March 22nd?
During the last board meeting, a resolution that was written in conjunction with the folks at Pacifica, both on the board and on Pacifica management, which basically does one main thing which Pacifica hadn't done prior to this resolution, and that was recognize that the stringers are striking, and there was a legitimate work action against Pacifica management, specifically Pacifica news management at the time, and this agreement, this resolution does that. One of the other things that it does is says that they won't censor news and public affairs throughout the network, which was another key issue that the stringers had been fighting for. Those negotiations were obviously done with a very friendly group of people. Dan Coughlin is now the interim director, executive director of the Pacifica Foundation. Verna Avery Brown is now the interim deputy executive director, who is also a longtime voice of Free Speech Radio News. The negotiations were really simple once the board meeting took place because all the groundwork had been laid months prior to that. It's a lot of phone calls. It's a lot of networking. It's a lot of making sure that the language protects and preserves the mission of the Pacifica Foundation, and yet at the same time also preserves the basic tenets of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship, which is that we will remain a bottom-up organization run by the reporters, organized by the reporters. You know, the trust level there is that we're all willing to be professionals in this, and we're after the same thing, which is the mission and supporting the mission of Pacifica.
That was Randy Zimmerman of Free Speech Radio News. For more information, visit the website www.fsrn.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Nigel Reese, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.